Nearly 100 years ago, the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution banned liquor. You probably know that time is prohibition, but you might not know that some anti-liquor advocates teamed up with the KKK to target immigrants, especially Italian and French ones in Illinois.
Plus, students of all ages are using more technology in the classrooms than ever before, whether it's laptops, tablets, or other devices.
And it's been a tough few years for farmers who sell produce through CSAs, in part to more competition from big grocery stores and others cashing in on the local food market. How these farmers are adapting and what policymakers can do to help.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
All of that and more coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, tens of millions of students use connected devices, whether we're talking about Chromebooks or iPads. Millions more use online apps. In fact, more than 30 million K-12 students use web apps like Google Docs or Gmail. That's according to the New York Times. So how do educators make sure that they're serving their purpose inside the classroom? Today, we're going to hear from two schools that approach this in very different ways. And later on, we'll be speaking with a researcher about what we know and don't know about the effects of technology in education. Adam Geisen is an instructional tech coach and longtime high school English teacher at Triad Community Unit 2 in Troy. That's in southern Illinois. They're about half an hour across the border from St. Louis. He helps train district teachers on how to use technology in the classroom. Carol Trajano currently teaches 7th grade humanities at the Waldorf School in Chicago, where they have no devices in the classroom until high school. Adam, Carol, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nyla. Appreciate it.
Morning. Good morning to both of you. Adam, let's start with you. So you've got about 3,800 K-12 students in Triad Community Unit 2. What kind of devices are we talking about in classrooms, and at what grade level are you using these?
Well, we just started going fully one-to-one from grades 2 to grades 12. So we've got pretty much the entire district minus kindergarten and first grade is one-to-one with Chromebooks. So that's the big, the bulk of the devices that we have there. At the kindergarten and first grade level, we're kind of split. There are some Chromebooks, not full class sets, not fully one-to-one at first grade, but they're starting to get on them. And at kindergarten, we're using iPads and some Android tablets too. So it's kind of all a mix, but it's Google heavy.
And so one-to-one, does that mean every child has a device?
Every child has a device. And from sixth grade to high school, they take them home. It's assigned to them at the beginning of the year, and then they can use it, and it's theirs until the end of their high school career, really.
And you've been a teacher for a long time, but now your job is to educate other teachers on how best to use technology in the classroom. I wonder if you can share with us some of the ways you think technology has helped students.
Obviously, with technology, engagement is going to be the big improvement. This is the world that these kids are living in. The technology is a big part of their lives, and so in order for us to stay relevant, you know, we feel like school has to sort of reflect that. And so we're able to find the right applications, the right websites, the right tools that increase that engagement, but aren't necessarily just using technology for the sake of using technology. And it's our job. My cohort, Mike Wilgus, and I service the whole district, and we do our best to try to find these applications that improves engagement, but it also is really challenging students and making them, you know, become critical thinkers and become, real creatives in the classroom, and that's really our focus.
And do you worry that having this technology in the classroom all the time could make kids more easily distracted?
I don't think so. And we obviously use tools that we have some tools that we use to sort of monitor their use in the classroom while the class is actually happening. But really what we see and what we try to teach our teachers to do is to make the lessons so engaging that they are not necessarily tempted to become distracted. And when these kids are doing something that they're interested in, when they're doing something that really challenges them, we see that engagement grow and we see the distraction decrease. And so, like I said, it's really not so much for the technology. It's really more what the kids are doing that makes the technology beneficial.
That's Adam Geisen. He's an instructional tech coach for Triad Community Unit 2 in Troy, Illinois. We've also got Karen Trigono on the line with us from Chicago, where she teaches at the Waldorf School. Carol, what's your school's approach to technology in the classroom?
Well, we really have adopted what we call a slow approach. It's not a no approach, it's a slow approach. So what we took a long, hard look at what is the appropriate time, at what age, to sort of bring these tools to our students in a way that they will be able to master them. And we really feel that comes in the middle school when the child has, you know, is beginning to develop, you know, critical thinking, good judgment. And so we have adopted in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade a program called Cyber Civics. And this is about providing students with opportunities to talk about, you know, amongst their peers and with a teacher, two teachers actually, you know, how can I be an ethical, responsible citizen online? And even in that class, we don't actually have any computers in the classroom, but we simulate a lot of role-playing. We give a lot of problem-solving. The kids work together on different projects so that they can really, you know, begin to understand how you become a master of technology. And we really have put a huge emphasis in our classrooms from kindergarten, you know, through the grade school. The high school is different, but this huge emphasis on sort of human-to-human teaching. Teachers working with students in not just sort of the typical academic approach, but also things with like how do you do art and how do you do handwork and how do you really develop these things that will grow your imagination and creativity. And so we really want to make an emphasis on, you know, how do we approach a whole bunch of different subjects, including in middle school technology, so that they can walk out with a sense of confidence that I'm not just dependent, you know, on this one thing. And also, I think we all understand that there's can be a tendency with technology to really kind of become isolated. You know, you've got your headphones, you've got your screen, you're kind of in your own little world. And so we really want to work with students on how do you learn to work collaboratively with others? How do you learn to look somebody in the eye and say, you know, I've got a problem with this, or teacher, I don't understand this? And how does that relationship really develop an atmosphere where the kids can, you know, learn as much as they possibly can, not just about the subjects, but about, you know, how to be a human being in the real world?
Carol, you all are, the Waldorf School is obviously a private school. I wonder what your teacher-student ratios look like across your school in terms of how many teachers you have or how big your classroom sizes are.
Our classroom sizes range from about 22 to 30. I am a main class teacher, which means I'm responsible for a certain number of academic skills classes. But we also have a whole host of special subject teachers. So we teach Spanish and German. We teach handwork. We teach gym. We teach art. We teach woodwork. We teach movement. We teach music. So, you know, it comes down to like one teacher for 15 students if you count in all these special subject people.
Adam, I wonder for you all, obviously you're a public school district. I mentioned how many students you have. What do your student-teacher ratios look like across the district?
It's really similar. We have, at the elementary levels, anywhere between 25 to 28. And then as you get up into high school, you could see classes as high as 30, but that's about where they cap. So it's very, very similar. You know, and again, same type of thing. While we do have technology as a tool, our focus is really to not necessarily use it sole as the only way of teaching, but as just an extra a way to get the content across and to have them practice. And, you know, it's not necessarily so much a taboo issue as it is here's how we could use it appropriately. And so that those types of things are being addressed as well, just like Carol said, we start a little earlier.
That's Adam Geisen from Troy, Illinois, and Triad Community Unit 2 schools. Carol Trigono is also with us. She teaches at the Waldorf School in Chicago. Both of them, of course, like all teachers, are concerned with the well-being of their students. And so is our next guest, Ellen Wartella. She's a professor and chair of Northwestern University's Department of Communication, and she directs their Center for Media and Human Development. Her research focuses on the effects of media and technology on kids. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Ellen, as you're hearing both Adam and Carol describe the two different approaches to technology in the classroom, as we're thinking about changing paces of just media and technology, and it's happening so fast, I wonder, do we know about how things like tablets or Chromebooks affect learning for kids?
We have some data, some preliminary data, absolutely. We know that through a variety of mechanisms that, at least in small studies here and there, that the uses of the technology really depends on three things. It depends on the age of the child, and I was really pleased to hear both Carol and Adam talk about using technology or talking about technology in different ways with different age children, and middle schoolers are ready to talk about these sort of ethical questions that obviously kindergartners not. So we know that the effects of technology depends on the child. It depends on the content, and here it's quite clear that some content is better than other content for different age children, and to the extent that Adam is out searching for good apps and good content for children at different ages is really important. And when you think about the fact that there are 50,000 apps or something for kids, how do you find the good ones that will both be engaging and actually teach them something? And third, it's the context. And here, again, I was impressed to hear that the context is using technology as a tool so that, particularly for the younger children, they're scaffolding by adults who can help them negotiate and using the apps. And for older children, they can begin to use it in the context in which they understand how to approach the technology in both reasonable and ethical ways. The only other thing that I'd comment about is there's some disagreement in the literature about whether the one-to-one ratio of every child having an iPad, let's say, is appropriate for young children. There's some research that's been done out of my lab and other places that suggests that the younger grades, having children work in pairs is perhaps more effective way for them to negotiate the iPads or the technology in the classrooms. But clearly one-to-one technology, one iPad to each child has been popular in a lot of the school systems, and so we really have to see what effect it has over the long term. The only other thing I might add is that both Adam and Carol and schools around the country are acknowledging today that children are growing up in a technologized world, and it's a world that particularly the parents of today's young children are very comfortable in. And in the research that we've done, we did a national population survey about 3 years ago with the parents of children from birth to age 8. We found they're very eager to have their children embrace technology at young ages, especially fathers were eager about this, with the acknowledgement that growing up today, today's young people are going to be in a world that maybe even has more technology than we have today.
Ellen, I wanted to ask you about when we think about parents, one of the news articles that inspired this conversation was actually some reporting the New York Times did about how in Silicon Valley, some of the people who help make these devices, of people who work at Facebook or Google, they don't allow their children on them at all. And is it as simple as saying devices are good for learning and some aren't, no screen time? I wonder how, if it is really that simple.
Well, I think that what you have to do is you have to monitor it, and you can't have your child or your adult be on screen all the time. And so there are good rules going back to lots of other technologies that you limit the amount of time that you spend with the technology. You monitor how it's being used, and that monitoring is done differently for a kindergartner than for an adolescent. And you, to the extent that you can, you exclude technologies at certain places. I believe not at the dinner table. It shouldn't be an hour or so before going to bed, and certainly not in their room at night when they're going to bed, that there are ways of trying to teach and model appropriate uses of technology. The American Academy of Pediatrics has long said that screens should be limited to 2 hours a day or less. It gets harder once you think about screens today, particularly mobile phones and iPads being used for not just entertainment and playing games, but also for communication and for a whole host of connections. And so that kind of rough estimate of how much time kids could spend with screens is sometimes stretched on either end.
That's Ellen Wartella with Northwestern University. Adam, Carol, I wonder if both of you could weigh in how much you think schools can model good behavior, or schools can provide a path for families to understand a little bit more about how they should be using technology with their children. Carol, let's start with your thoughts on that.
Well, our parents have actually come to us over the last several years and asked us, like, can we have some guidelines? What are your recommendations? So we've done a lot of research, and we actually have put something out to our parents about this slow approach, that, you know, what's appropriate for our kindergartners is going to be completely different for the kids that are in seventh and eighth grade. And they've been very, very appreciative of it because, like all of us, they're kind of overwhelmed too. They don't want their kids getting hooked on technology. Sometimes it can be hard to set limits. And so we feel like we're working in a partnership to, you know, provide this opportunity to help them develop into healthy, you know, find these healthy pathways into technology, because it is a part of the world and we want to embrace it. It's just what's the right thing at the right time.
Adam, we just have a few minutes. Just I wonder briefly if you could answer that as well.
One of the ways we've addressed that is to bring coding really to the families. Coding is sort of the focus at the lower levels. We can do pretty simple block coding with some applications and some tablets that allow kids to really practice problem solving and creative thinking and that kind of thing at a really early age that gives them time and ways to do that. And we've had some evening some events where families can come in, kids can code together with their parents, so parents can see, here's the kind of stuff they're doing in school. It's not just watching YouTube videos, and we're not just, you know, playing simple games. We're actually creating things, and we're making things happen with our creative thinking and with our critical thinking in order to accomplish goals. And I think that, you know, when parents can see the stuff that we are doing at school and that it's not just a screen that they're watching, they're creating things with it, then we can see real magic happen. And that's what's important.
Thanks for that. That's Adam Geisen with Triad Community Unit 2. I want to thank Carol Trigono with the Chicago Waldorf School and Northwestern University's Ellen Martella. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What comes to mind when you think about prohibition? Maybe you think about jazz, speakeasies, even gangsters like Al Capone here in Chicago. Well, there was a lot more to it than that, including anti-immigrant violence in many American cities and towns. In many cases, they were led by the KKK, which actually grew in numbers during prohibition. One particularly dark chapter in this history took place in Williamson County, just east of Carbondale. And what happened there, including how many immigrants were killed and how the public pushed back, is part of an opinion piece that Lisa McGurr just wrote in the New York Times. She's a professor of history at Harvard University. She's also author of the book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. And she's on the line with us now. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Lisa, before we get to what happened in Southern Illinois, I just want to start by asking you about prohibition. I mentioned Al Capone in Chicago, and I think people have maybe popular conceptions of what the era was, and I wonder what you think is missing from that.
I think what's missing from the popular conception is the darker side of prohibition. There is a tendency, a sort of way that we look back and romanticize the escapades of these adventurers and criminal networks from Al Capone to the underground subterranean nightlife, all of which was very real. But there's a very different side to prohibition if you look outside the big cities, or even if you look to kind of working class neighborhoods, which is that prohibition was enforced. It's often thought of as a joke because we focus on the sort of unending supplies of bootleg liquor. But the other side of that was that if you were a sort of immigrant or working class or a kind of rural moonshine supplier, prohibition was enforced and men and women were arrested, fined, and incarcerated for liquor law violations, this was the moment that you see the first sharp rise in the numbers of those in prison at the federal level. You have to remember that in 1920, the FBI was very, very tiny. At that time, it was called the Bureau of Investigation. And it's really prohibition that launches a far greater and qualitatively new role for the federal government in crime control, one that continues after prohibition is rescinded. So all of these are the kind of really important legacies of prohibition that we tend to forget when we focus on gin joints, jazz, and speakeasies.
It's such a different picture that you are painting, which is, I think, really helpful for people to understand thinking about really the rise of the modern criminal justice system as we know it today. So it started at during this era, it sounds like you're saying.
Absolutely. It did start in this era. And of course, remember, the federal government was not the colossus that we know it to be today. And of course, you know, we have a huge, you know, prison population. We've had a war on drugs for the last 50 years. But in this moment, the federal government took on that role for the first time. And at the same time, while there was a huge escalation of its efforts to rein in law and order, to enforce the law, because this was such a hugely ambitious project, right, the idea of banning alcohol from shore to shore, and because the federal government was very, very small, there was no way it could meet the impossibly large ambitions, even though it put in all sorts of efforts. And men and women that had worked so hard to pass it became increasingly dissatisfied. And that is why we get what I talk about in my book on the war on alcohol, the citizens launching a kind of citizens enforcement apparatus, a kind of shadow enforcement army to back up the official law enforcement apparatus at both the federal, the state, and the local level.
So, Lisa, I wonder how then this, as you're talking about the size of the federal government, as you're talking about sort of all of these different state laws, this is where we're also seeing these kind of citizen armies that are trying to enforce prohibition, right?
Right. So essentially, you have coming into prohibition, this was, of course, a long campaign. It had started in the 19th century already. There were very powerful and influential national, what were called temperance organizations, that worked starting in the early 20th century to pass a constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was one. The other was the Anti-Saloon League. Both of those organizations, once prohibition passed, did not retreat to their homes, but really wanted to work to make to see that the law succeeded. And they morphed to a certain extent into enforcement organizations. They worked with local, state, and federal officials to help ensure the law's success. And the motto of many of them was, every citizen an enforcer. It wasn't enough, in other words, to respect the law, but one had to sort of take on an active position in seeing that other citizens respected the law as well. And this, the Anti-Saloon League and the Women's Christian Temperance Union worked to establish local law enforcement organizations. And they quickly found an ally for that work in the reestablished Ku Klux Klan. With the passage of prohibition, it really flourished, not just in the South, but also in the Midwest and West, where there was a lot of temperance sentiment among white, Native, Anglo-Saxon Protestants who were deeply concerned about drinking, but drinking as a symbol of the changes and shifts that immigrants and Catholics were bringing to the country. And prohibition offers the Ku Klux Klan an opportunity to sell itself to white Protestant evangelicals, those men and women who had worked so hard for the law, as a law enforcement organization. If the police weren't going to do their jobs, they would step in. So it provides a kind of a legitimacy for their 100% quote-unquote, American campaign.
And so, Lisa, an important example of all of this actually happened in Williamson County in southern Illinois, just east of Carbondale. Can you tell us a little bit about how the prohibition worked in Williamson County in particular?
Williamson County was very different. If you're thinking about Illinois as a whole, you know, Chicago was a heavily immigrant city. It was a very wet city. Williamson County, Illinois, had been settled largely by, it was a kind of, Southerners had moved in from Virginia, from the Carolinas. It was largely a kind of native white Protestant and heavily mining community. But in the early 20th century, the mining opportunities had brought in a more diverse group of folks who lived there, including many Italians and French immigrants who came into the community who were also Catholic. There had always been drinking, despite the sort of efforts of Protestant ministers to rein in the drinking of minors. And Illinois had not passed a state prohibition law, but when prohibition came about, those who had worked so hard to pass the law, who saw the continued violations of the law in their communities, Williamson County was also the home of two well-known criminal gangs, liquor supply gangs, and as a result, there was an enormous amount of violations of the law. So essentially, you know, there was an effort by both Protestant ministers and the leaders of the community, particularly a man named Sam Stearns, who was the chair of the Williamson County Board of Supervisors, and was also the leader of the local Ku Klux Klan. Sam Stearns essentially launched a campaign to rein in liquor law violations, but that campaign effectively targeted, again, the drinking of others and brought in white Protestant miners who had earlier were really just concerned about their economic grievances and the problem of, you know, the eroding conditions in the mines, into a new campaign to target the drinking of Italian immigrants who also happened to be competing with them for jobs in the mines.
Yeah, so that's so, really it. So it's there's an economic part of this story that people often maybe miss.
In Williamson County, there's absolutely an economic piece. I think that Stearns and Protestant ministers drew in a portion of working class miners precisely because there was a lot of anxiety at this moment. You know, mining was a sick industry in the 1920s. There was increasing job competition. There had been a huge and very, very violent strike and lockout that ended in what's called very well-known Heron Massacre, in which there had been two labor union members who had been killed. And in response, there were a number of mine guards and scabs, essentially, who working-class miners ended up killing. In other words, class violence. And I think there was a lot of anxiety among the middle-class folks in Heron about that. And essentially, the law and order crusade that was launched in the wake of the Heron Massacre redirected some of those anxieties toward another target, which was essentially the men and women who had come across the sea. And that's precisely how they identified the threat. In some law and order public meetings, they actually argue that those who are responsible for eroding your way of life are those immigrant men and women from across the sea. And they promised that they would essentially force them out.
And there was actually violence, right, at this point, where also there were actually anti-immigrant violent incidents that happened?
Oh, there were. I mean, there was essentially what happened was a campaign of what started out as a kind of prohibition enforcement effort that first targeted the Burgers and the Shelton gang. Sam Stearns himself went to Washington, D.C. He got federal authorization by the Federal Prohibition Bureau in order to launch these crusades. But what are these anti-liquor campaigns? But essentially, they deputized citizen volunteers, between 500 and 1,000 in a series of raids, who spread out across the county, raided sometimes roadhouses and speakeasies, but also raided private homes. Basically, it became a campaign of terror against the immigrants living in the community. The local priest in a oral history interview said that 17 crosses were burned at the time nearby. The Catholic Church itself was raided. Crucifixes were thrown on the floor. This campaign of terror resulted in Italians calling on the vice consul in Springfield to come and take affidavits about the violence they had experienced, about planted evidence about the violation of their rights. Eventually, in another area of Williamson County, the French immigrants called on their consul, who protested to the State Department. In the end, this level of violence, which ended in 14 deaths, and the fighting in the streets led to the calling in of the National Guard, led to essentially local martial law established by Len Small, the governor at the time of Illinois. And there was so much controversy and violence that it eroded support for the Klan by 1925. And there was a shift. So immigrants were not passive in this. There were those who organized in Illinois, but in other parts of the country as well. It was called the Knights of the Flaming Circle, to basically fight back against the Klan. And they also fought back politically. By 1928, immigrants, many of whom had not been involved in the national level in politics, came into the Democratic Party when Al Smith ran, because he was both an immigrant and a Catholic and anti-prohibition. And what we often, I think, understood is a kind of symbolic issue, prohibition being a kind of symbolic attack. In reality, it was concrete and a very, very real grievance for immigrant men and women. In Williamson County itself, about 3,000 immigrants out of 11,000. When it started in 1920, there was a population of 11,000 immigrants. I think the Klan's campaign succeeded in driving over 3,000 out, because the census shows that in 1930, there were 3,000 less immigrants
wow.
in Williamson County.
So, and when we think about that, Lisa, I wonder, you did mention, though, at a certain point, the public actually turns against the Klan. What does that look like in Williamson County? Or is there is then a backlash against this?
There is a backlash in Williamson County. There is, already there had been a backlash more widely in Illinois. So there was a state law that banned the Klan from parading in masks. And in Williamson County, they had totally, said that had been, they paraded in masks right up until 1925. But one, somebody who had been a Klan supporter ran for mayor in 1925 on an anti-Klan platform, essentially saying he would enforce that law, and that succeeded. And there was an erosion of support for the Klan. Eventually, the leader of the anti-liquor raids, a guy who was named S. Glenn Young, who had been a kind of champion for the local Ku Klux Klan, was killed in a gun battle. There was a huge Klan rally at his funeral, which brought in Klansmen from around the state. So they were still active, but there was an erosion of support among officials and very much a backlash. And even evangelical Protestant ministers who had been supportive essentially hold a kind of revival meeting, seeing the level of violence and controversy in the streets, in which they call on, basically their own brethren to turn to prayer and not to sort of, be fighting gun battles in the streets.
Lisa, I wonder, you are a historian, you teach history. I wonder, though, how you see parallels in America today to everything we've been talking about.
The story of Williamson County shows, I think, the way in which particular economic anxieties that at one moment can turn around class hostilities focused on, for example, sort of inequities of private economic power, at another moment can be turned to scapegoat immigrants as the reason, even though it's not legitimate, but nonetheless the cause of one's economic concerns and grievances. I think you absolutely see a parallel. That's what happened in Williamson County. It's what's happened under the Trump administration in terms of, the sort of massive attack on immigrants as the cause of, let's say, American decline or crime. You saw that in the 20s. Immigrants were targeted by, those who supported prohibition as the sort of causal force for crime. In fact, if you looked at the statistics, immigrants were far less likely to be involved in bootlegging than other Americans. There was a study in 1929 which by Edith Abbott that showed that, but there was a scapegoating of immigrants, so that the Indiana, for example, WCPU declared that immigrants were 75% of liquor law violators, a statistic they simply took out of thin air. So there is that kind of targeting and scapegoating, but there is also, I think, what one can see in terms of a parallel to today, a counter response, a mobilization by those who are targeted and attacked unfairly to enfranchise themselves increasingly and become involved in politics. We saw that in the fall election in 2018. We have a far more diverse congressional body in the House, I think, coming out of 2016 as a counter response. And I think we will see more of that counter mobilization going forward.
Lisa McGurr teaches history at Harvard University. She's also author of the book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. She first wrote about this as an opinion piece for The New York Times, and we'll tweet that out for you to read more about this. Lisa, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. CSAs allow consumers to buy produce directly from small farmers, but times are actually pretty hard for CSA farmers. The market's gotten a lot tougher in the past few years, and that's led CSA farmers to try to adapt in order to stay competitive. So we've gathered a couple folks to talk about this. Shay Balahi is one of those farmers. She's a part owner and farm manager of Blue Moon Farm in Urbana and in studio with me now. Hi, Shay. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Simon Huntley's also on with us. He's the founder and CEO of Harvey. That's a company that helps small farms with marketing in technology. Hi, Simon. Thanks for being here, too.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Shay, you first started this farm you started your own farm 7 years ago, and you've been with Blue Moon Farm since 2015. Choosing to go into farming is itself, I imagine, a pretty big decision, but why did you want to work on a CSA farm specifically?
So actually, when I joined Blue Moon Farm, they weren't a CSA farm. It was a program that I helped implement when I moved there. But I really like connecting directly with my customers and establishing a relationship, and find that that's the best way to help build community.
Mm-hmm. And so you brought some carrots with you today that look beautiful. What are you guys growing right now?
Right now, we are mostly growing inside of our greenhouses, which helps us be year-round. We've got spinach and salad mix, baby bok choy, some baby kale, some big kale, Swiss chard, collard greens, and we've got a lot of brassicas that we've planted by hand out in the field.
So I wonder how it's different if running a CSA farm versus a traditional farm, where you are, and I imagine there are some farmers who probably do both, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, CSA farm is a little bit different in that you have to plan to have something reliably for several different people every week. So you need a steady influx of product to supply to your consumers.
And how have the past few years been for you guys and for your business?
Pretty, you know, they're changing. It's changing overall for our farm. But we're doing pretty good. We're staying relative in the market. We're staying connected with our community, which we find is the best way to stay within giving produce to our community is direct to the consumer.
And are you finding there are more competitors in your space now?
Definitely. The market has changed for sure. We're noticing a lot of bigger grocery stores that offer organics where before it wasn't as widely available. And the convenience factor changes how the market works, for sure.
Simon, I wonder if you could explain a little bit more. You work with not just Shay, but other CSA farms across the country. Are we seeing this across the country increase competition in the local food market, essentially?
Yeah, it's definitely happening across the country. And Harvey has been developed by my company to help farms address these changes. And I really started to notice it 4, 5, 6 years ago. Certainly when I started being involved in CSA farms in the early 2000s, this is really the only game in town as far as getting local, sometimes organic, not always organic, but produce. And so that has really changed in the last 10-15 years. And we're seeing that effect on our farms.
So what are the biggest challenges that farmers are telling you they need help with, Simon?
It's really about keeping members year over year. So that's one thing that we look at is how farms can have really good retention rates and how can they make their customers happy. I mean, oftentimes they're growing great produce, right? And they have this great connection. Shea does a really good job of connecting to her community members. And so this is really a special thing that's out there. Like there's no, you're not going to get this at a grocery store. You're not going to get that connection to your farmer at the grocery store, but through a CSA farm or a farm share, you can do that. And so we just put a couple of tools on top of that to make it customizable, nice payment plans, really good support, recipes, things like this. So we put this, you know, just make it a little bit more customer friendly and let the farms do what they do. And they're really succeeding with it.
Mm-hmm. So Shea, you introduced us to Simon and to Harvey. What has Harvey done to help you guys?
Harvey's really been amazing to help us with the technology aspect, making it easy for our customers to sign up. But even better than that, it's allowing us to offer fully customized boxes to our consumers, to our customers, our farm shareholders. Over the last few years, when we reintroduced our CSA program on our farm, most of the feedback that we got from our customers is that they wanted more flexibility in what they got in their boxes. So the thing that Harvey does is allows every single customer to go in and rate all of our vegetables on a scale from 0 to 5 or 1 to 5 based on how much they like it. And then Simon's created this algorithm in the background that creates a box for the customers every week based on what they like. So they're not forced to eat beets if they don't like beets.
Which is kind of always, I would say, the common refrain with the CSA is when people get a box and there's stuff in there that either they don't know what to do with or they don't like.
Exactly. And Harvey also supplies recipes. So if you're stuck, you know, you've had tomato soup for the 1,000th time, you want a new way to use tomatoes, Harvey provides recipes for every box that is made for each customer.
And is that harder for you if you're customizing? Is that a challenge for you in terms of the growing side?
It is a little bit more challenging, but not really. We are really diverse on our farm and we have a lot of different products. So we're able to put limits on, you know, if we only have 20 pounds of arugula, we can put a limit on that. And so it does make it a little bit easier and it adds additional challenges in different ways.
Mm, right. It sounds like so probably a lot of things you did not think you would be doing when you were getting into farming, right?
Yeah.
We're speaking with Shea Balahi with Blue Moon Farms in Urbana. Simon Huntley's on the line, founder and CEO of Harvey. That's a company that helps smaller farms with marketing and technology. And I want to introduce Guillermo Payet, founder and president of Local Harvest. That's a website and database for CSAs and for farmers markets. He's based in California in Santa Cruz. Hi, Guillermo. Thanks for being with us, too. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Guillermo, I wonder if you can respond to something Simon said about how kind of the competitive edge that CSAs have is thinking this is a chance for you to know your farmer. But I'm thinking about grocery stores now where they have people coming in and this is like a meet the farmer event. And they're trying to also, I think there's in the grocery store space, everyone is kind of recognizing the narrative and wanting to capitalize on people knowing their farmer. Are you seeing this happen all across the country that CSA farmers are having to compete with at this level?
Yes. We work with about 7,000 CSAs in the country, Local Harvest. We have a few hundred that use our CSA Ware service, which is a competitor to Harvey. And what we've seen also in the last few years is about 40% decline on the size of the CSA market. The entire CSA market maybe 5 years ago was around $400 million a year, not very big. Now, I think that the problem for CSAs is not so much the local grocery chains, which, I mean, they are actually kind of a little bit of a marketing venue where people can see the produce for a particular farm, and then if they know about the CSA from that farm, they can subscribe directly. But the main problem has been the meal kit companies. The meal kit companies.
So this is like the HelloFresh, Blue Apron, all of those kind of things.
Right.
Okay.
Those companies, their current market is about $1 billion a year. That's like three times as big as CSAs are right now or more. Now they're doing that at a loss. Blue Apron was losing $100 million a quarter a year ago. Now they've managed to cut that down to something like $20 million a quarter, which is still pretty bad. I mean, they're losing money like crazy, but competing with CSAs. I mean, their whole marketing is very farmy, right? It's like they were created to capitalize on the CSA space that small farms had created. So that is the main thing that is hurting the small farms right now, the CSA farms. I mean, we've seen in Illinois, I mean, we work with 152 currently active CSAs in Illinois, in Local Harvest. The average share size is 65 subscribers, so it's not a big market. But still, we've seen, at least we know of 8 CSAs that have gone under in Illinois in the last couple of years.
Mm. Shay, I wonder if it's frustrating for you as a farmer to hear what Guillermo is talking about. You're talking about building community and wanting people to be connected with you as a local farmer, but then you maybe seeing people who have interest in cooking their own food finally, but they're buying it from this big company that's obviously not a local company.
Yeah. So I think we kind of look at those. I mean, as he said, they're losing money. They're not sustainable. They can't keep working at a loss.
Just trying to capture your market share.
Exactly. The thing that we are benefiting from Blue Apron and HelloFresh is that people are learning to cook again. And their retention rate isn't that great. So what it does is it helps people get familiar with new vegetables and new things and be able to cook. And then once people fall out of that that HelloFresh or Blue Apron thing, it's easier for them to transition to CSAs, get the product, and be able to use it in a similar way, probably at a much cheaper cost. And there's a lot of waste, plastic waste that goes on with Blue Apron, and CSAs, we're able to limit that waste, which is a benefit that we have.
Simon, how are you working with folks like Shay? I wonder what advice you have for other people in terms of trying to stay competitive and stay afloat in this space.
Yeah, it's tough. I think what Guillermo is saying about these meal kit companies, very true. One thing that I noted is that I think this has gone down a little bit, but Blue Apron was willing to spend $144 on marketing to acquire a single customer. And this was at the time when they went public. So one of the things I see as a problem within our sort of local farming community is that we don't really market ourselves really well. I mean, we have this great product, you know, that people really want. People do really want to support local farms. They want this really fresh product, but I think in many cases, people don't even know that these programs even exist. So I think that we need to get better at marketing within our community.
Right. And obviously, Shay, you are farming, so marketing is like a whole other job. Guillermo, I wonder what you want people to know about CSAs as we're thinking about the spring and as we've been having this conversation. What do you want listeners and consumers to know?
Well, my hope is that eventually we're going to go back to the slow organic growth on the space that we used to have until 5 years ago. That would happen when this food 2.0.com bubble that we're seeing right now pops, which I think eventually will. Now, what we're seeing right now in terms of like farms that are doing well, I mean, we see a lot of farms that are shrinking in the size of their CSA, but we do work with a few that we see that they're growing. And the two main things that we see on those is some are competing with the meal kit companies in terms of all the bells and whistles, convenience, customizability, all these things. And we provide the tools to do that as well. But then also we're seeing that a lot of CSAs are really retaining their markets really well or growing. Some are growing by just focusing on community, like Blue Moon. They bring up the idea and refresh that to their members that they are part of a food shed, that of a food community. It's not just buying
But it's not just the transaction of this, right, Shay? And that's what you said about the whole idea of community when we're thinking about Blue Moon Farms. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank Shay Balahi for being with me with Blue Moon Farms, Simon Huntley with Harvey, and Guillermo Pyatt with Local Harvest. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If you want to reach out to us, you can always go to our website, 21stshow.org. That's the best way to reach us. If you want to follow us on social media, send us an email. Just go to 21stshow.org. It's also where we've got all of our past shows. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify as well as iTunes and NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff is our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.